Welcome to the Princeton Public Library. It is gorgeous. This is Studio 2 on the road, where today we're on location in Princeton, New Jersey. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. In the world of artificial intelligence, there are often two sides, doomers and boosters.
The doomers say artificial intelligence will ruin humanity, that it will displace jobs, worsen wealth inequality, erode privacy, and pose an existential risk to human values while consuming vast amounts of energy.
Sounds bad. The boosters say artificial intelligence will make us smarter, faster, and more efficient. This will untap our potential by freeing us of clerical burdens, giving us tools to solve problems at a rapid scale, and providing vast access to personalized learning at the touch of a button.
And here in 2025, it seems both of these visions could come true. And the question behind this debate is, where are we in the trajectory of history? How fast is this all coming at us? And what do we need to do personally and as a society to prepare?
Let's hear one answer to that question from Dario Amodei. He is CEO of the major AI company Anthropic, which develops the large language model Claude, which I love that name, by the way, for a large language model. Here he was in January on CNBC's Squawk Box.
At some point, we're going to get to AI systems that are better than almost all humans at almost all tasks. The term I've used for it in an essay I recently wrote is a country of geniuses in a data center. It's a sort of evocative phrase for all the power and all the positive things and, you know, all of the potential negative things. That's the thing that I think we are quite likely to get in the next 2 or 3 years.
So, are we 2 to 3 years away from a country of geniuses in a data center? Or perhaps are these the words of the industry hype machine?
Well, we have two fantastic guests from Princeton University to help us sort through it all. Tom Griffiths is the director of the Princeton University AI Lab. Tom, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi there. Well, it's great to be here.
And Arvind Narayan is a Princeton University professor and co-author of AI Snake Oil, What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't, and How to Tell the Difference. Arvind, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We actually want to start this conversation by talking a little more optimistically about some of the things that AI can do, but also could do in the future. And I think, Cherry, you wanted to talk about medicine in particular. Is that right?
Are there some examples of things that AI could do to make medicine better? Could AI help us solve some really big problems, Tom?
Okay, so I think there's a couple of ways to think about this, right? So one way is, how is AI transforming research? And that's something where I think we have really clear, you know, sort of quantitative indicators of, you know, progress that's being made in that space. So, you know, one example of this, the Nobel Prize for chemistry in 2024 was awarded for an AI system, right? Mm-hmm. And it was an AI system that could solve a problem that chemists had wanted to solve for a long, long time, which is the problem of protein folding, which is, you know, if you're given a molecule, can you make a prediction about what shape that molecule is going to take? And that turns out to be really important for doing things like designing drugs and you know, many, many applications within biology and, you know, having implications down the line for things like medicine. And so the way that that AI system worked was being able to take these kinds of flexible artificial intelligence techniques, training them on huge amounts of data that chemists had collected, and then being able to then create a system that could solve that problem better than any previous system could solve it. And that was something that then transformative for impacts in chemistry. And I think we're just starting to see those kinds of impacts across other disciplines too.
So it's not, you're saying it's not just chemistry, it's even not just science. Just like doing academic research in general, we could see an acceleration aided by AI.
Yeah, and that's part of what we're trying to do in the AI lab at Princeton, is identify these places where there's the potential for transformative impact from AI and support those efforts in a way that makes it possible for that impact to be seen across the entire campus.
Yeah, and I think about education, too. I teach a class at Temple University, journalism law, and I've seen what I believe is AI show up in some of the responses and papers of my students. But people say that AI could help because you could tailor education and learning to individuals. Is this an avenue where AI could be helpful?
Maybe. I mean, let's...
the tone of that maybe was notable.
Skeptical.
Okay. My answer to everything is going to be maybe, but let's not get too excited and think about historically what has happened. So 10-plus years ago, there was a big wave of excitement around so-called massive open online courses. And the pitch was, look, the internet has made it so easy to put everybody's videos online. Why should these elite Ivy professors only teach those chosen students who've been, you know, lucky enough to get through the admissions process? They should be teaching everybody in the world. So we're going to put these lectures online. We're going to enable this. And all the other colleges are going to go out of business. And everybody's going to learn from these Ivy League professors, right? That turned out to be a completely bunk theory of education. What we offer to students is not that we are, you know, special in some way and have knowledge that others don't have. The reason that education in the context of a university works is that it creates the social environment in which learning can happen. That's the primary value that we offer. So it turned out that trying to digitize this, in fact, lost the essence of what makes education succeed. And so I don't want to diminish the impact of online videos. It's been tremendous, and it's enabled so many people to learn, but it has not in any way decreased the need for colleges and universities, right? So I think we should have that same perspective.
Well, maybe not
with
decrease
AI.
The need, but it could enhance what is already offered, correct?
It could certainly enhance. I'm not saying that AI for education is useless. I use AI all the time to learn new topics. But the way that's usually pitched is that this is going to transform education because teachers, you know, can't personalize to every student, and now AI is going to do this. But what the teacher is providing is not necessarily just their knowledge or their ability to interact with each individual student, but the social environment for learning.
The class.
That's the fundamental thing we have to keep in mind. Enhance, yes. Replace, no. That's the bottom line.
Let me ask, though, about the ability of AI to, like, even some playing fields. So I'll just, like, give a hypothetical. Like, if I don't speak Spanish. If I moved today to a country where Spanish was the native tongue, I would be at a huge competitive disadvantage in the marketplace. There's all sorts of jobs not open to me. But if I had a tool that allowed me to express my ideas to someone who speaks Spanish, then I could sort of bring my full creativity to a wide berth of jobs. And all of a sudden, like, the field of applicants for a job gets a lot broader. All of a sudden, you know, if you don't get as good a start in life and you don't get sort of like the pedagogical training you need in reading or writing or math, you might be able to make up, you know, that gap some point later using an AI tool. Can you talk, Arvind, about the possibilities that AI could, you know, shrink some inequalities that are baked in to the labor force?
We're already seeing this, and it's not just in the labor force. So I think one of the ways in which AI impacts have already been profound is for people with some kinds of disabilities. And for instance, there's an app called Be My Eyes, and this is before the modern wave of AI. What it allows it is for a blind person to call a sighted volunteer who might be somewhere else and show them through their phone their surroundings and help them, the volunteer would describe to them what their phone is seeing, essentially. And now, actually, AI can do that. It's not necessarily as good as a person doing it through the phone camera. But the AI is always there, and you don't have to worry about privacy so much if exposing your home to someone, on the other side of the world. And so you can imagine what a big difference this makes. And it's a kind of equalizer, right? Yep. It's in spirit the kind of thing you're getting at. And I think a similar thing is happening in some labor markets. There's a big debate going on in the academic community about whether AI is making the top performers perform even better and increase inequalities, or if it's allowing some of the struggling performers to level up their performance.
Take us inside that debate. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So there's two ways you could imagine AI helps people, right? You could imagine that there is a ceiling to performance on a particular task. Let's say your job is translating, boring government documents into other languages. There's not a lot of room for creativity there. You just have to get the job done, right? So here, you could imagine that it's actually helping the struggling performers to catch up by automating some of that work. On the other hand, you might imagine that it's a task that involves a lot of creativity. And there, if you're more adept at using AI, and if you're more adept at assessing AI outputs because you're the world's leading expert at that thing, maybe you get to benefit from it more than someone who
you're better able to tap into the power of the tool, and exactly. therefore the person that was a little bit worse than you yesterday is now 10 times worse than you.
Exactly. So it really depends on the job.
Wow. And so we're talking about labor, and we're going to have to shift over because one of the biggest worries, I think, about AI is that it's going to replace us. It's going to take our jobs away. And so now let's hear from Sam Altman. He's the CEO of OpenAI, which develops ChatGPT, and he's bullish about how humanity and work will evolve through an AI revolution. This was Sam on Adam Grant's Rethinking podcast. Take a listen.
Eventually, I think the whole economy transforms. We'll find new things to do. I have no worry about that. We always find new jobs, even though every time we stare down a new technology, we assume they're all going to go away. It's true that some jobs go away, but we find so many new things to do and hopefully so many better things to do. I think what's going to happen is this is just the next step in a long, unfolding, exponential curve of technological progress.
So, Arvind, I know you've been very skeptical on this topic of AI generally. So this is your chance. I mean, historically, what Sam Altman is saying has been very true, but could it be different with AI? Will we not evolve? Will jobs be lost? Make your argument.
Let me give both sides of this. I mean, there's a saying, you know, never make predictions, especially about the future. I try to not make a lot of predictions, but
I know.
But let me give you two scenarios how things could play out, right? So one is what we heard from Sam Altman. AI automates some things, we find new things to do. And that could be true in some cases. For instance, a doctor's job, for instance, AI can do some of that. Doctors already use AI in some ways, simple things like transcribing notes. But what a doctor does involves dozens of different things. And so it's fairly easy to imagine how, as AI gradually gets better at some things, what it means to be a doctor changes over time so that it focuses on the things where the human element is essential and AI cannot or should not automate. Probably a bad idea to have AI automate doctor-patient interactions, even if in some abstract sense it's capable of doing so. That's one kind of job, but there is another kind of job. There's a reason I mentioned a translator's job before. Those are areas where we're already seeing tremendous job losses due to AI. Stock photography is another one. So what has happened here is that the structure of this job is different from the structure of a doctor's job. It's not a job that involves a bundle of a dozen or a few dozen tasks. It's a job that involves one task. And this is a job that has already been unbundled before AI hit the scene. And that's where we're seeing these strong impacts. When labor protections have already been stripped for a particular job, and it has been turned into a kind of gig work, and it has been turned into this kind of parcelable, easily replaceable kind of labor, those are the kinds of areas where I think the impacts from AI automation are going to be really negative.
Altman's point is that we've seen this play before, like the Industrial Revolution displaced a lot of workers. It also created a whole new class of jobs. Yes, there's disruption, but ultimately we work through it. Is there any reason, Tom, it would be different this time? I don't know. Maybe it's just the speed. Maybe it's the scale. Is there a reason to be more fearful because of the nature of this particular technological change?
So I think part of the fear and, you know, maybe part of the reasonable concern here is that what's being automated is cognition.
Yeah.
Right? It's that.
That strikes deep, you know,
yeah, that's
as
right.
a human being that just strikes you. Yeah.
That thinking part of us that is the way that we've thought about what it is that, you know, defines what it is to be a human being in some ways, right, is the part that's being automated. And that creates some existential concerns. The other side of that is that it's an opportunity to develop a different kind of skill. And that's something where if you're somebody who's, say, a manager, you are used to engaging in a mode where you're not getting work done necessarily by doing all of the thinking yourself, but by creating an environment in which that thinking can happen and you're able to reason about who's the right person to ask about this particular thing, and who's the right person who might be able to help you with that, and who's, you know, how do you think about those tasks being allocated? And that kind of thinking about thinking is something that's, it's not cognition, it's, we call it metacognition, right? So metacognition is something you can do about your own states, thinking about your own thoughts and how to regulate them. But it's also something you can do about other people, where you're really trying to think about, you know, the competencies that people have and the ways in which they can be deployed. And so one of the changes that we can see here is a change from an economy where the skills are cognitive skills to an economy where those skills are metacognitive skills. And something like that already happened in things like finance, right? Where it went from being something where an individual trader is focusing on the trades they're going to make and sort of executing their things, to something where now you have people who are thinking about creating algorithms that are going to execute those trades. And so they're thinking about, you know, this metacognitive level of what's the right way to specify an algorithm that's going to do this, rather than at the level of the individual atomic trades.
Yeah, when I hear that, I think those are, because you talk about finance, that's high-level jobs, right? And I'm thinking, who's going to get left out of this? Because what types of jobs would be created? Are these jobs where it would require high levels of intelligence, high levels of education? And who would be left out of this wave? Arvind, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, let's go back to the Industrial Revolution analogy that you brought up, Abhi, because that, I think, is a good way to answer this question. So Sam Altman's point was that historically, we've always been fine. That's kind of true. Let's think about what happened in the Industrial Revolution. Eventually, it led to a great increase in living standards and economic growth. That took several decades. What happened during those several decades was a drastic change in the nature of what labor meant. It was mass migration of people from farms and towns into big cities, where they lived in tenements.
You're talking about Charles Dickens, basically.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Exactly. Horrible conditions, low wages, child labor, horrific rates of industrial accidents. And that's actually what led to the modern labor movement, right? Because the way we thought about jobs at that time was not sufficient to protect those people. We're going to need that again. If we're going to come out okay at the end of this, it's not enough to say history worked out well. We have to think about what it took for history to work out well. And hopefully we can avoid, you know, 3 decades of misery this time.
I hope so, too. That was Princeton University professor Arvind Narayanan, the author of AI Snake Oil: What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't, and How to Tell the Difference.
He and Tom Griffiths, who is the director of the Princeton University AI Lab, joined us for the live Studio 2 on the Road event we hosted last week at the Princeton Public Library.
And as we've been listening back to this event, we've been getting great emails and comments on our YouTube live stream. Here's one from Langston, who says, I use AI all the time for my own business. It does concern me that it's going to take so many jobs. The best thing we can do is adapt and learn to use it for our benefit.
Yeah, and we still want to hear from you, our listeners. What do you think about the rise of artificial intelligence and the risks and opportunities for the future? You can email us at studio2@whyy.org or drop a comment in our YouTube live stream. Hey, YouTubers.
We're about to go to a very short break, but we will be back with much more from our live event, including insights on AI-generated deepfakes and reaction to our Cherry and Avi AI voice clones. Spoiler alert, they're freaky. It's coming up on Studio 2.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. The bulk of our show today is from the live event we hosted last week at the Princeton Public Library, all about the state of artificial intelligence.
But we also want to hear from listeners today. What do you think about the rise of artificial intelligence and the risks and opportunities for the future? You can email us at studio2@whyy.org or drop a comment in our YouTube live stream.
Now let's get back to our conversation with Princeton University professor Arvind Narayanan, the author of AI Snake Oil: What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't, and How to Tell the Difference.
And also Tom Griffith, the director of the Princeton University AI Lab. Arvind starts us off here responding to a question about how quickly AI is going to scale up and have a major effect on society.
I think a lot of the fear that the timescale is going to be dramatic is coming from thinking about advances in AI technology, AI capability, AI methods. That's not the only level at which we can look at it. So these methods are improving, like Tom explained. But then it's not enough to have a smarter AI. You have to actually build products out of it so that people can use it, so that it can transform various jobs, et cetera. So that's actually happening at a much slower pace than we're seeing with the rate of improvement in capabilities. And when ChatGPT came out, it was predicted to be an overnight revolution. That was true in some cases, like students cheating on homework. That did, right? That did start to happen overnight, but most jobs have not been transformed overnight. Yeah. When you look at how much the average American worker is using any form of AI in their job, it works out to something like somewhere between half an hour to 3 hours per week. That is the latest estimate that I saw. And that's not overnight transformation, yeah. right? And so it probably is going to be faster than the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, I think it's more relative speed, right? Because you could say, well, I'm certainly not an expert in this, but Stone Age, you know, the proliferation of stone tools probably took a while. Totally changed humanity, but took a while. And then Industrial Revolution maybe feels slow looking from our modern lens, but far faster than that. And then if this is, you know, exponentially faster than the Industrial Revolution, then you're like, ew.
It's scary.
Tom, what do you think about that?
I think we're also at an interesting moment in the development of these kinds of technologies where for about the last 10 years, there's been one trick that worked really well and sort of surprisingly well, which was taking exactly the same models, essentially, and just giving them more data and more computation. And that's the bet that, you know, like every AI company and every, you know, major technology company has gone all in on. That's why the stock for NVIDIA, which creates the GPU chips which are used to train these models, has gone through the roof, right? There's like huge demand for the computer resources that you're going to need in order to train these models.
More power, baby. Yeah. It just feels like someone revving an engine, you know?
Yeah, and The other part of that, though, is that even as that, you know, power is building, the amount of data in the sense of, you know, like, you know, internet text that has been used to train things like the large language models is starting to asymptote, right? So we're sort of starting to get to the point where that resource is being tapped out. And so that means that people who are building models that are based on those kinds of data are now having to look for other things that they can use to juice up those models, right? So just in the last year, a lot of the innovations that have come from models have not been from getting bigger and using more data, but for using computation in a different way, which is enhancing the capacity of those systems to do computation at the point where you're asking them questions. So if you've interacted with a large language model recently, it might have done a thing where it looked like it's thinking while it's trying to come up with an answer to the question. And that's using that additional compute to allow it to sort of generate parts of an answer and then use those parts of an answer that it generates to then inform what it ends up telling you. And so there's, I think, a real question about whether the rapid development that we've seen is something that is going to continue. I think it's maybe a moment where we're going to see a little more of a sort of branching out and exploring different kinds of strategies as those models are being developed.
Fascinating.
When I think about speed, though, I think about ethics. Like, what are going to be the rules and the guardrails of this and how it can impact so many parts of our life? I know AI doesn't have ethics, but it's being trained, right, on our ethics and our ethical decisions. Is there a lot of opportunity here for bias, for flaws? And it's getting baked in as this thing, this train is moving so fast, Arvind.
AI bias has been an issue throughout the history of machine learning. Machine learning, as Tom explained, is learning from data. The data comes from people. It bakes in human bias, and that's going to be reflected in AI outputs as well. I think it depends a lot on what we're using AI for. It's one thing if we're using it to generate text. It's quite another if we're using it in the criminal justice system or for hiring people or various other kinds of things. That's, I think, one big distinction to keep in mind. I do think in the latest generation of AI models, there's been a lot of progress in mitigating that bias. It's not nearly enough. Things are at least moving in a better direction. But where we have a big gap, coming back to the question about speed, is the ability of policymakers to rein in some of the really problematic uses of this technology. Here's the most stark example of this. If you were to ask me what is the number one AI harm that's happening today, to me, by far, without question, it's the issue of using image generation AI tools to create these non-consensual deepfake nudes of people, obviously primarily women all around the world. So many high school kids are doing it. It's an epidemic. You may have started hearing about this recently, but it's actually not even new with the latest generation of image generation models. There's a report from 2019 showing that back then it was happening at the scale of hundreds of thousands of images. That should have been a wake-up call for policymakers. It wasn't. It was only after last summer it happened to Taylor Swift that they started paying attention after her images were uploaded to Twitter. And, you know, that shows you the speed at which policy moves, and that's not okay.
I think there is a real significant question of how to stop that, because I think, like, the general consensus is that's bad. Then you try to create the systems that would stop it at scale, and it sounds daunting. I mean, Tom, are there systems at scale that can, like, thwart these really abusive uses of current AI technology?
I mean, I think just to sort of echo Arvind's point here, the other thing that's moving more slowly than we would want is our understanding of these systems, right? So all of the effort in industry is going towards this kind of arms race of just creating the next best model. And that means that models are being rolled out before we necessarily understand how it is that they work and, you know, what the underlying capabilities of those systems are and the ways in which they fail. And so that creates a lot of these risks that are associated with these systems. Is one of the properties of the kinds of deep neural networks that underlie these systems is that we don't really understand how they work. They're sort of notoriously hard to interpret. They come up with solutions that are not intuitive solutions, like the kinds of things that, you know, we might think about for solving a problem. And as a consequence, it's, you know, this is a pro if you want to hype these models, because you can say, we don't even know what capacities they have,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it's a challenge if we want to be able to legislate or, you know, think about how to define rules of engagement for working with these systems, because we don't really know what capacities they have.
This is sort of like a lighter version of what we've been talking about, but we're talking, you know, a lot of people have concerns about art and creativity and truth. To do that, we want to illustrate how easy it is to make deepfakes. By playing this clip, our executive producer, Kevin McCrory, put together yesterday. All it took was an $11 AI voice cloning account and a couple of completely unrelated source files of Cherry and I talking.
Thanks for the great setup, Human Avi. This is an AI simulation of Avi Wolfman Arendt's voice. And next, we want to talk about how AI is raising all sorts of questions about privacy, intellectual property, and distortions of truth.
I have so many questions and concerns, Avi. Even though I'm a simulation of Cherry Gregg's voice, I can't help but worry about how the ability of artificial intelligence to replicate voices and images is going to upend the trust we have in all sorts of communications. Now, if I must, I guess I'll send the conversation back to the human version of Cherry.
All right, so yours is bad.
You could tell that wasn't me. You could tell that wasn't me. Yours was pretty good. Yours was pretty good.
It was pretty good. And there were a couple moments where I heard it pause the way that I pause.
Yeah.
And it was, that's what really freaked me out.
Yeah, my voice is much warmer than the AI version.
Cannot be imitated. They're going to AI me next year. You'll be here for 100 years.
But you think about what AI can do. I mean, that took, what, like $11? And I mean, just a few minutes. And earlier today, our executive producer translated my voice into German. I mean, it took a couple of seconds. And so when we think about the capabilities of AI to clone people, to clone images, we've seen deepfakes going viral during election season, you know, how can we even think about the guardrails? Because you talked about legislation can't keep up. I don't think Congress has the ability to figure this out. And so who's going to be the entity? Who's going to decide what the guardrails are? Who should decide?
So art is actually an interesting case where there are some technological solutions that people have started to explore. And this is something where it's not a regulatory thing, but it's a thing that maybe starts to empower artists, where
they develop visual ways art in this case.
Yeah, so ways of essentially sort of poisoning models. So you can have a way of manipulating an image such that if a model ingests it, it's not able to use that image in the way that it might, and, you know, for training those models. And so
artists can protect themselves.
Yeah, you know, to some extent, right? But those are the sort of first steps towards, I think, thinking about how to create some of the kinds of protections that people might want for around things like intellectual property and so on. But
yeah, I'm going to be the optimist this time around. This might be shocking. yes, there are many risks from voice cloning. Scams is one, right? Calling up someone pretending it's a loved one, they've been kidnapped, and the threat to artists. And you're absolutely right. Congress is not going to do much about this. But I don't think the situation is as dire as it may seem, and there are things we can all do as individuals to protect ourselves. I mean, look, the voice cloning scam, that has actually been happening long before AI. There are so many voice actors who can pretty convincingly imitate someone, especially if they're being kidnapped and their voice doesn't necessarily sound normal. And that's been happening at a level of tens of thousands of scams per year. I guess that's my optimistic news. But AI hasn't dramatically increased a scammer's ability to do that because they were kind of already doing it. And the answer now with AI is the same that it was before AI, which is that if we get such a call, we just have to remember not to panic in that moment and actually call our loved one and see if the call was real or not. And in the case of artists, look, I mean, here's my potentially optimistic take on this, right? There was a similar concern in a very unrelated domain, chess. When a couple of decades ago, chess computers started becoming way better than even the world champion. And it was widely predicted that people are going to stop playing chess. What is the point in seeing who's the best chess player if a computer is vastly better than any human? The exact opposite thing happened. Interest in chess has dramatically gone up, and a big part of it was because of computers. And this is an example of how it's up to us to choose what to value. The chess community as a whole decided that just because chess computers are better, it doesn't mean that they no longer value human chess. So that's a choice we can make, and that's a choice that I hope we will make with art as well.
Okay, so it's related to this, which is the game of Go. And unlike chess, Go is an interesting case where the superhuman systems were created very suddenly, right? So there's this sort of moment in time where we went from not having a superhuman Go player to having a superhuman Go player, the system AlphaGo. And so that means that we can actually look at what Go play is like before and after that moment as a little bit of a simulation of what happens in a particular domain when a superhuman AI is created. And what we've found in looking at the play of serious Go players after the introduction of AlphaGo was that there was an increase in the quality of the moves that they played. So they started to play better moves, and there was an increase in the creativity of those moves in the sense of they were playing more novel moves. They were playing sort of like earlier in the game, they'd produce something that no one had ever played before.
Hmm.
And so that's something which, gives me a little bit of hope in the same way that it's an illustration of how having a system that is in some way smarter than us in some specific domain gives us an opportunity to explore new things that we might not have thought of on our own.
I want to bring in another bite here because we were talking about guardrails, and I think we all pessimistically concluded that the government guardrails are probably not going to keep pace. So that means that the products that are going to create the guardrails are going to be developed by other technologists. And we have this is a student studying in the Princeton AI lab, Kevin Wang, and his biggest fear about AI is how it's putting a lot of power into the hands of a few big CEOs like Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and Sam Altman, to name the most well-known. Let's hear that clip.
The concentration of power within these few companies and the heads of these few companies is something that we really need to sort of look out for, especially like with the increasing power and money that AI brings, like that also gives them an increased influence in, for example, like our government, right? It becomes sort of like a negative feedback loop in the sense that if that falls into bad hands, then that could be disaster for, like the common person or like the working class.
I would jump off of that and say, is it fair to expect the same general group of people who are developing the technology to also develop the technology we need to make sure it doesn't get out of control? Arvind?
No, is the simple answer. That one definitely has an easy answer. I think we don't have to rely on the same group of people. There's a field called public interest technology. This is the idea of funding technologists to develop technology in a way that's not beholden to any company, but instead thinks about what's in the public interest. That is a woefully underfunded field, but that's something we can choose to change. That's something we can choose to, you know, channel philanthropic dollars to. So again, I think there are a lot of choices we can make differently. Let me put in one last word for regulation as well. It's true policymakers move very slowly, but that doesn't mean policy is useless. One thing we forget is that a lot of things we are worried about are already unlawful. We talked about bias and discrimination a little bit. Using ChatGPT to discriminate against someone's job application because you're using AI to analyze their resume, for instance, that's already unlawful. It has been for more than half a century. It's not specific to using AI or not using AI. You can't discriminate in hiring, right? So it's a matter of enforcement. So as long as our enforcement agencies are up to the task, even if Congress is kind of asleep at the wheel, there is a lot of good that policy and enforcement can do.
That was Princeton University professor Arvind Narayanan, the author of AI Snake Oil, What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't, and How to Tell the Difference.
He joined Tom Griffiths, director of the Princeton University AI Lab, for that live Studio 2 On the Road event we hosted last week at the Princeton Public Library.
And as we've been listening back to the event, we've been getting great emails and comments on our YouTube live stream. I want to read one from Rue Diego from YouTube, who says, I love AI to help solve issues with data analysis and assist with decision making, but it shouldn't replace professionals or override them in decision making.
And here's a great email from Kay, who says the biggest danger from AI isn't that it's going to wake up and take over the world. It's not actually intelligent. It's the same ones and zeros programming with a fab PR campaign. The big danger is to our grid and to our climate with continued reliance on fossil fuels. And we still want to hear from you, of course. What do you think about the rise of artificial intelligence, the risks and the opportunities? Email us studio2@whyy.org. Or drop a comment in our YouTube live stream.
And after a very short break, we'll be back with much more from our live event, including tips for parents who have teenagers using AI.
And then apropos of Kay's email, we'll answer everyone's burning question. How freaked out should we be about killer AI robots? I hope not freaked out, but we're going to find out. On the other side of this break, you're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The bulk of our show today is from the live event we hosted last week at the Princeton Public Library about the state of artificial intelligence.
We still want to hear from listeners today. What do you think about the rise of AI, the risks, the opportunities? Email us, studio2@whyy.org, or drop a comment in our YouTube live stream.
Now let's get back to our conversation with Princeton University professor Arvind Narayanan, the author of AI Snake Oil, What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't, and How to Tell the Difference.
And also Tom Griffiths, the director of the Princeton University AI Lab. Both fielded great questions from our live audience there in Princeton.
But first, Avi starts us off here with the issue we know you've all been waiting for.
Look, I gotta ask, because I'm certain someone came with this question today, and I've had this question myself. Killer robots, AI run amok, everything you see in sci-fi movies, like Arvind, how realistic is that? It's just a silly question, but like, is that a real risk? Theoretically, in the future, that AI sort of gets loose into the world and subjugates humans.
The way you frame this debate, right, boosters versus doomers, I found very interesting. A lot of the AI company CEOs are actually doomers. And, you know, that's very surprising. You wouldn't think the incentives for them are to play up the doom angle, but kind of perversely they are. Because their argument is this is such dangerous technology that we should get there first before our adversaries do. And we're the only ones who can understand how to build it for the betterment of humanity. So the doom argument has actually, ironically, made these companies a lot more powerful in terms of their rhetoric and the amount of deference that they get from policymakers and from journalists and others. I want to argue that that's not even the right way to frame the debate when we're taking in these doom arguments, we're automatically assuming that a lot of the talking points of these companies, that AI is so powerful that it is capable of doing these things, to be true. And I think we should be very cautious of accepting that and seeing these two as the poles of the debate. And yes, we should be worried about these theoretical risks. Yes, people should be researching them. There is a community of hundreds, perhaps thousands of researchers who are thinking carefully about these risks, and that's a good thing. So far, the way that we build AI has shown no signs that these are realistic risks we should worry about with this technology. We should have transparency into what's going on inside AI companies. That, I think, is the number one risk. If they're building AI in ways that these risks are becoming more realistic and not telling us, that's what we should worry about, as opposed to, you know, abstractly thinking about, could there be killer robots one day?
Well, that's good. That was good news, Avi.
No, yeah,
that was good news.
Okay, so we're going to open it up for questions. I think the way we do this is just sort of, you know, raise your hand.
Yeah, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate all the insight. So I'm a mental health specialist, but I'm a mom and I have a teenage daughter. So I kind of wonder, what are some pointers to help her in terms of sort of being a citizen in this AI and internet world, and how to support her? Believe it or not, she discovered ChatGPT on her own. She was using it, and I've been guiding her, but I kind of wonder, I mean, I definitely don't want her to be, no, you cannot do it, but then I can see that she needs to understand. So I want some pointers to help me through it.
That's a good question, yeah.
I think this is related to this point I was making before about this idea of sort of metacognition, right? Being able to build this skill of reasoning about the capabilities of the agents that are going to be acting on our behalf. So I think it's great that you're letting her interact with that system as a way of learning something about what kinds of things those models can do. Hopefully one of the things that she's discovering by doing that is discovering that they can't do everything they claim to be able to do, right? So if she starts getting it to try and do her geometry homework, she's going to discover that most of the time it can give you the right answer. Some of the time it gives you the wrong answer, but it's really hard to tell whether the answer that it's producing is right or wrong. And that continues to be a challenge for those kinds of systems. So I think giving people the chance to learn about not just the capabilities, but also the limitations of these systems is really important. One real challenge for interacting with these AI systems is that we as human beings have a set of intuitions about how minds work that are based on interacting with other human beings. And the capabilities of these systems are very different from those of human beings. So you might have an expectation that because somebody can solve one problem, they're going to be able to solve another problem. And there's nice research that's been done by economists that shows that, you know, this is the way that people sort of reason about AI systems, and it turns out to be completely wrong for these AI systems. The way that they're built, their capabilities sort of don't line up in the same way with, you know, different areas of knowledge in the same way that we might think that a human being does. And so I think developing not just an ability to use these systems, but an appropriate skepticism about their ability to do things for us is really important.
Quick follow-up on that. So, like, we would infer, we have a plumber come over to the house, they know how to fix a leaky faucet. We would infer they know how to fix the leaky bathtub as well. But you're saying the AI, it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So it might be that in their training data, they had a lot of leaky faucets and they didn't have a lot of, leaky bathtubs. And so they're great at leaky faucets and really bad at leaky bathtubs. And one of the things that I do as a, you know, psychologist as well as a computer scientist is apply some of the tools of psychology to trying to figure out what the limitations of these models are. And by doing that, we can reveal they do all sorts of really weird things that are not the things that we expect. So, for example, they're not particularly good at counting things, right? But you can show that if you ask them to count how many letters appear in a sequence of letters, if it's 30 letters, they're more likely to give you the right answer than if it's 29 letters. And the reason why is that the number 30, which is the answer they're going to produce, occurs more often on the internet than the number 29. And these models have been trained to, you know, capture the statistics of the internet. And so that very small difference makes a big difference in the way that the system performs. And that violates the expectations that we have about how things like counting work, right? If someone can count to 30, you think they can probably count to 29 as well.
Yeah. A few more questions. So many more questions. Yes.
My name is Jennifer Salas. I'd like to know if you have insight on research that's been done maybe in the last 3 years or 5 years on how AI has actually had impact on medical diagnoses, anything that the medical community has truly been using AI for to better life expectancy.
There's a few different ways in which AI can be used in medicine. When we talk about AI, we usually think about generative AI, and certainly there has been a lot of research on comparing doctors doing diagnoses to AI doing diagnoses. And it's tricky to interpret the results of these studies. These studies are very often hyped, overhyped, and are presented as, oh, look, ChatGPT can pass the US medical licensing exam and it can do diagnoses better than doctors. But the thing is, a doctor's job isn't to answer medical exam questions all day. And so when there is a more holistic evaluation of how well these models can help physicians in clinical settings, they still are useful, but not in a way that I, you know, that you would think of as revolutionary or something like that. So there's room for some cautious optimism there. But a way in which AI has been used in medicine for a very long time is more traditional algorithms. So for instance, when a patient is hospitalized, can you predict sepsis early based on all the vital signs and all of the information that you know about a patient? That's somewhere on the continuum between traditional statistics and modern AI. So those types of systems are often, you know, have been developed, deployed, tested, and are being used in hospitals all over. Not necessarily revolutionary, but that's pretty much an everyday occurrence in terms of AI in medicine.
And we have time for one more question, unfortunately.
Thank you for being here. I'm a high school history teacher. My name's Trevor. I'm here with my colleagues, Matt and Ellen, so shout out to them. This question's for Arvind. Looking at more of a labor-related question. So we talked about the public research into AI, and I think we've come, at least I've come to the conclusion that if we had more regulation, possibly public ownership, that could reel in some of the negative consequences. When we look at things like the Industrial Revolution, we see kind of capped in the 1930s and 40s with the New Deal era, we're able to have more regulation and social safety nets to off-put any of the negative consequences of the Industrial Revolution. Is there any type of burgeoning labor movement within people that work in AI, and if there is, you know, can you please enlighten us? If not, do you think there's some type of appetite for one?
Absolutely. So I would say that the most important category of people who work in AI that we should think about is the ones who are not getting the headlines in the press. These are data annotation workers who number in the millions, who are often in developing countries, countries like Kenya, who are doing the work of clicking all day and training AI to give more appropriate responses, for instance. So ChatGPT is trained on text from the internet. Yes, that's the first step. But then there is the step that involves a massive amount of low-wage human labor, and it's pretty much invisible labor. Sometimes it's called ghost work. And the conditions of this work are so poor that very often AI companies are turning to refugees, people in prisons, people seeking asylum, those types of populations.
I did not know that.
So I think that, I would argue, is kind of a crisis. And yes, there is an emerging labor movement to improve the conditions and recognition of those types of workers, but also build transnational unity because this is kind of a global labor supply chain.
I just learned, I did not, I think everybody is shocked by this, that people are working for low wages to train AI. I've never heard that.
And the training they need to do is looking at the most awful stuff on the internet all day, the videos of beheadings and gore and whatnot, to make sure that that doesn't get into the input or output of AI.
That sounds deeply traumatic. We do have to leave it there. And I just want to thank...
Wait, Avi. I got to stop. We got to leave it. Okay, thank you.
I was going to
thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I was going to say, amazing questions. Perhaps you all should have done this interview. The questions were that good. It really was a pleasure to be here in Princeton at this beautiful library with this amazing crowd. And I just want to thank, first, all of you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And we should thank our guests as well, Arvind Narayanan, who is a Princeton University professor and co-author of AI Snake Oil, What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't Do, and How to Tell the Difference. Arvind, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Tom Griffiths is the director of the Princeton University AI Lab. Tom, thanks for the time.
And that was a recording from the live Studio 2 on the Road event we hosted last Thursday evening at the Princeton Public Library. Thank you to all the library staff who helped us out.
Thanks again to that great audience. And we do these once a month on the road. We would love for you to join us. Perhaps we'll be in your backyard this month or in the coming month. So please do go to whyy.org/events
for all the latest on upcoming Studio 2 On the Road events. We've also been discussing the state of artificial intelligence all hour, getting great emails and comments on our YouTube live stream. Any standing out to you right now, Cherry?
We got an email from Sally who said, tech can do good things, but right now it seems too skewed to, number one, addicting us with the dangerous scrolls. They can change these algorithms, she says. And number two, using our data and our keystrokes for free to develop this, and then tech makes all the money.
Yeah, lots of negative comments overall, I would say. Jay emails, citing the example of the Industrial Revolution is not comforting. It brought us a lot of inexpensive stuff. It also enabled us to build lots of inexpensive bullets, bombs, and airplanes. Unless we have established strong systems of control, we will repeat the situation of the Titanic, the ship that had lots of power but not sufficient control to enable it to avoid the iceberg. Okay, so anti-Industrial Revolution take there from Jay.
Yeah, and this email from Andrew who says, I used ChatGPT for the first time a few days ago. Turned out to exemplify garbage in, garbage out. I asked a question that, unknown to me, had a misstatement in it. ChatGPT took me at my word and supported my misstatement. That's one of the things we learned during our conversation with our two experts. It's not reliable.
Yeah. But it's very improv coded. It's yes and.
Exactly.
You tell it something and it parrots it sometimes.
And I know we're about to go, but I was so shocked about the labor. I started doing research over the weekend and I was like, I'm still blown away that so many humans are doing the work behind the scenes.
Well, a good conversation spurs further inquiry every time. So thank you again to everyone that joined us in Princeton. And let me thank our Studio 2 team. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calake were our studio engineers today. Charlie Kyer was our live engineer in Princeton. And our executive producer is Kevin McCory.
Yes, from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.